Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of the Squawker Talker podcast, the podcast where we dive into the weekend's action, looking at all the key stats and the best stories from the weekend and giving our expert take on it, although some people don't think we're experts anymore after last week's. Joining me to do that is an actual expert. It wasn't Mo's fault that we got Twitter hate, was it?
Kind of it was though, was it? Let's be honest. No, it's we'll be out in good time, it's all in good fun. We just love to talk about football, don't we?
We just love talking about it. We want to find the stuff that people don't find. And someone that's expert at doing that as well is Mr. Will Hall joining us.
Hello. Ready to prevent you guys making some needlessly provocative takes.
Yeah, you weren't here last week.
I do feel like I dodged a bullet.
You did.
Just skipping that one.
Sam, there's a reason Sam's not back on, because we're pinning it all on him and he's been sacked from the Squawker Talker. But because of the success of that episode, which was one of our best ever, so thank you all for listening, we've been able to purchase new podcast equipment, which means an extra podcast guest. And joining us for his debut on the Squawker Talker is the brains behind the Squawker social media team. It is, I am only Tom Green. What's your Twitter at, mate?
Only one Tom Green.
Only one Tom Green. And there is only one, and he's on his Squawker Talker podcast debut. And there was no perfect opportunity to get you on the Squawker Talker, Tom. You were watching the Old Firm Derby this weekend whilst on shift, and we had a listener's question from Reese Callahan that said, if anyone on your team has watched the Old Firm, could you just give us a brief overview? So before we dive into this weekend's big standout stats that we've got lined up for you, just a shout on an Old Firm Derby, which was feisty, to say the least.
Yeah, I often watch most of the Old Firm derbies, and they're always such a great watch. But yesterday's one, I think, was changed or defined by Morelos' red card. You can obviously see that he was targeted by Scott Brown for antagonising, and it worked because once again, he reacted and got his fifth red card of the season. And essentially, I know they did manage to level eventually, but essentially lost the Old Firm Derby for Rangers.
Is Morelos' sort of temperament going to prevent him? Because he's always linked with a move away. Do you think that's going to put teams off? No one's going to look at Rangers' superstar.
Well, if you look at his stats throughout the season, he has scored 27 goals. I know it is only the SPL, but 27 goals for a 22-year-old is a phenomenal record. But this is obviously the biggest aspect of his career that he needs to work on, which is his temperament. Like, he can't move to another club and continue with this.
Imagine if he played all those games he was suspended. He'd probably be on about 40 goals. And before we move on again to the Premier League action that we're going to get stuck into, massive shout out to the 85,000 crowd that turned up for the Checker J Trophy, which was a record in the competition. Portsmouth becoming the second team after Wolves to win the English Top Flight and the Football Trophy, which is obviously not a desirable double necessarily, as it shows.
Big love to Ashley Birch.
They definitely got their money's worth from that game, though, you'd have to say.
It was a thriller at Wembley, and 85,000. Only the Catalan derby at the weekend had a bigger attendance in Europe.
And that's, yeah.
And Thomas Meunier was appealing to his Twitter followers for streams on this one.
Someone should have got him a ticket. It was sold out.
He should go to a prison for that. if he gets a legal stream sent his way.
Soliciting streams, yeah. Perhaps he's an undercover agent, and they were using him for people to link
in. Yeah, it was like entrapment for the streamers.
You wouldn't put it past those big dogs on the football world, would you?
A lot of big talent in it as well. Ada McGeady, Lee Catamol.
Ada McGeady scoring two. Which is, again, as I said, it's almost a fall from grace. But it was
showcasing his trademark McGeady spin.
Yeah,
as well.
Must be the only player playing at that level to have a FIFA move named after him.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a collective claim.
But he deserves it because it is a wonderful piece of skill. But someone that might have a thing in football named after them soon is the Hugo Lloris blunder, perhaps. We're going to start with Liverpool 2-1 Spurs. Which it's a shame that it boiled down to one inexplicable moment at the end with Hugo Lloris dropping the ball. That was his eighth error, leading directly to a goal this season. Only Jordan Pickford has made more with nine, which is Liverpool will be loving that. Everton goalkeeper at the top and Tottenham goalkeeper.
And
Pickford as well also gave one to Liverpool as well. But yeah, was that sort of... Did they deserve that, Spurs?
It, it, yes and no. I mean, I thought Liverpool played very well. I thought Spurs were awful in the first half. Just absolutely like, what was going on? He Pochettino got it completely wrong, diagnosed the situation incorrectly. I mean, and to prove how good he is, he did change it completely at halftime, and they were great second half. But Liverpool were fantastic. First half should have been way more ahead, kind of suffering at the end. But, you know, Klopp, as he always does, his team just sort of found a way. Lloris, I mean, he did it in the World Cup final. Everyone just sort of over forgot that because they were winning already. But, like, he literally did I forgot the guy's name already. He did a Karius in the World Cup final. In the World Cup final, that should have been, you know.
But it didn't cost his team.
It didn't.
The game.
So everyone forgets about it. But he's always going to have a Rick in him. That's clearly just the way he is. He's a fantastic goalkeeper.
He also has the opposite in him as
well. Yeah, exactly. Like he'll play brilliantly and make amazing saves. Like, whoa, Hugo Boss. And then
the one from Trent Alexander-Arnold sort of cross comes short.
Oh, just unreal. That goes in like 9 times out of 10. But it's just this weird duality of Lloris, because he's like, you can never say he's not brilliant, because he is brilliant. But then at the same time, you're never 100% secure with him in goal, because at any moment now, he could do something stupid. Mm. Like, and that was just, it was such weak goalkeeping.
Mm. And Alderweireld getting his foot stuck in the turf wasn't great afterwards, was it? In terms of, we've had questions in from James Richards that's saying, what's going wrong with Spurs, which is, again, that could be a whole podcast section in itself, but there's obviously areas. Trippier's come under a lot of criticism this season, and obviously was up against a marauding fullback on the other side. But in terms of Spurs upgrading, is there a case now to be made that Lloris shouldn't be Spurs' number one goalkeeper, Tom? Do they need someone else there, or is that too harsh?
I personally still think that Lloris is one of the best goalkeepers in the world. I know that he's prone to errors, and he needs to get that out of his game. Obviously, there was that period of time when he first joined the Premier League where he was quick off his line, one of those sweeper keepers, and he was one of the best at it. But again, it led to a lot of errors. I still think that he is one of the best keepers in the Premier League, and that Tottenham should keep with him.
No reason to put Gazzaniga in just yet for a Premier League game.
Well, I don't think so. I went to the West Ham-Tottenham game in the League Cup where Gazzaniga played.
We should have apologised early on that Tom is unfortunately a West Ham fan and was subject to quite a dismal performance this weekend. So Lloris in that game was...
I think Gazzaniga is just... No, Gazzaniga played the Cup game. I think Gazzaniga is just too much of a step down from Lloris. I know Lloris is prone to a mistake, but what he does bring...
He wins you as many matches as he loses you, then. Yeah. So it equals out, balance. But to move on to sort of... the key moment in that opening goal in the first 15 minutes was sort of Jordan Henderson just about getting it over to Robertson via Eriksen's head, who got an assist later on for his actual team. But that cross from Robertson was delicious. And it was his 9th assist, which is the most ever by a Liverpool defender in a Premier League season. He's now chasing the record by a defender, which is 11, held by Leighton Baines and Andy Hinchcliffe. But he was his incessant running down the line and the width he provides for Liverpool brings us on to a question of whether Andy Robertson and Liverpool's left back is the most important of his role in Europe, let alone the Premier League at the moment, Will.
Yeah, so the word important is important there. You may not think he's necessarily the best fullback in Europe, but I think there is no fullback in Europe more important within a team system fighting for major honours right now. Cool. And I think his nearest rival in this respect is Trent Alexander-Arnold. You could look at Jordi Alba at Barcelona with 7 assists this season. However, the fulcrum of Barcelona's success is like remained Lionel Messi, of course. Mm. Bayern have just bought a new pair of fullbacks, so that calls into question their importance. Juventus pretty elite, but I think their strength is in their core.
Well, Cancelo has had a good season, but also sometimes just finds himself playing right wing. So it's
moved into midfield, I think, as well. Or was that Sancho? But not only is the importance of Robertson and Trent Alexander-Arnold measured in terms of their output assists-wise, I think it's also evident in the compromises that Jurgen Klopp has made elsewhere within the team, often to the displeasure of the club's fans, because my theory is that the importance of those fullbacks is what led to Fabinho's place on the bench in all the big games this calendar year. I think there is only one instance in which Fabinho has played against elite opposition in 2019. That was against United at Old Trafford, and coincidentally, James Milner was having to stand in at right back on that. Mm. So in his post-match press conference, Klopp basically confirmed what many of us have been saying all season, and that's that he's engineered a dramatic departure from the playing style of last season in view of, in his words, winning football games much more often than they have in the past. So what changed? What compromises he made? Liverpool are basically actively choosing to funnel less creativity through the middle of the pitch.
We've said before. So it's on purpose that no one's created beyond 20 chances.
Well, I mean, so okay, yeah.
It is. Exactly. That's what I was hoping you'd say.
Only one midfielder for Liverpool in the Premier League this season has averaged per 90 minutes one chance from open play per game. And that midfielder just happens to be James Milner, who plays at fullback more than any other player. And it's basically what's led to players such as Jordan Henderson becoming a martyr of Liverpool's title challenge, basically, because he's just a beacon for criticism, always has been. But Liverpool's two fullbacks routinely advance further up the pitch than Wijnaldum and Milner, who are stepping in. And that leaves Henderson there to patrol the width of the pitch. Mm. Fabinho is a defensive midfielder. You could make a case he could do that. However, Klopp said earlier in the season that he's basically switched to the 4-2-3-1 system on occasion purely to help Fabinho adapt. And that suggests that he doesn't see Fabinho as a player who is quite yet ready to play on his own in the middle of the pitch when those two other midfielders, Henderson, Milner and Wijnaldum, step in at the fullback positions. Mm. Milner will step in for Robertson. Wijnaldum, less so, will step in for Alexander-Arnold. Even when Alisson is taking a goal kick, that is often the case.
And we've spoken before about, I know you've mentioned there that Milner doing it on the left-hand side, but we spoke before about the duality of Alexander-Arnold and Milner, almost interchanging positions within it. And my retort to Robertson being the most important was, from an Arsenal point of view, I tested it, and this goes to show how valuable Robertson is. Kolasinac has been sort of a cult hero among Arsenal fans this season, in the sense that Arsenal for a period of time looked like the only way they could create a chance was by him cutting it back. So I was thinking he's pretty important to Arsenal's success for a period of time, and he has created 10% of Arsenal's chances in the Premier League this season, 15% of their big chances, which is pretty hefty for a left wing back that's only played 1500 minutes. Robertson, 20% of big chances and 12% of all chances created. Yep. So my theory was busted.
I was going to bust your theory anyway, because when I said important, I mean important to a team.
I know, you said that.
Major honors.
So I didn't know you were going
to
bring in that.
I have to exclude Arsenal from the pool.
What, do you not think St. Tottenham's Day is a major honour?
To be fair, first of all, Arsenal can be for the Europa League. Secondly, if you watch the way in which Jordi Alba is absolutely fundamental to the way Barcelona attack, they don't have any width on the left. When Ousmane Dembele plays, he cuts in through, and Coutinho plays, and he cuts in. Jordi Alba is the entire left flank. At least a good 70% of Barcelona's attacks involve them. Ping, 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 ball around on the right. Messi cuts it out, cuts it wide to Jordi Alba. Jordi Alba gets the ball and either looks to whip it back to Messi or to someone else. It's at least on par with Robertson, if not more so, because Barca don't really use the right fullback in the same way Liverpool use Trent Alexander-Arnold.
How many assists has he got though, mate?
I think more of all competitions.
We'll stand into one of those troll Liverpool fans at the weekend. Luke Shaw equaled his assist tally from the past five seasons. And I may have gone a bit too over the top with the fact that he's been unleashed. Liverpool fans were quick to point out that Trent Alexander-Arnold had created 3 assists in one game this season. But in terms of open play chances created, Luke Shaw and Trent Alexander-Arnold are equal. So people need to be careful about assists in the sense, and I know you were saying that as a joke I know you were saying that as but a joke there, Will.
Assists, of course. Yeah, just to underline that. Because we need to learn the lessons of last week. But assists do speak to the quality of the chances being created.
And the finisher on the end of it.
As I've said, though, I do think Liverpool have the best fullback pairing in Europe right now, because I think whereas you look at Bayern have Joshua Kimmich playing right back, who's phenomenal, but David Alaba is nowhere near the level he used to be. Barcelona have Jordi Alba, but then they can't decide if it's Semedo or Roberto on the right. Liverpool consistently, Alexander-Arnold and Robertson are just phenomenal as a pair.
And to come back seriously to address the point of Jordi Alba versus Robertson, I don't think that Barcelona sacrificed the same level of creativity in the middle of the pitch that Liverpool do to get those fullbacks into their...
True, but that's because they don't have to.
Well, exactly. But the question was, is there a more important one? And if they don't have to, then that lessens Jordi Alba's importance for reasons beyond his control.
So my final point on this to end the discussion, which after all was, in essence... Liverpool 90th minute winner puts them back on top, so that's crazy. They needed that massively, and Arsenal can now go above Spurs if they're winning. Obviously, we're recording before the Newcastle game, but on that point of left backs, which obviously is so key, Robertson has been incredible this season. I would argue that because the duality of him and Alexander-Arnold is so important, if you then boil that down to one left back being important, I'm on Mo's side in the sense that Jordi Alba offers so much to that Barcelona side that when he doesn't play, it's a bigger void. So by virtue of Liverpool's fullbacks both being so good and both being used so often, I actually think if you were looking at one, Jordi Alba gets it.
Who's got more assists though?
Yeah. We'll move on from Will's incessant moaning about assists. A team that doesn't have many assists at all is the relegated Huddersfield Town. They deserve at least 5 minutes on the podcast.
Yeah.
Just sort of looking back at their season, which is a loose term, because after 32 games, equaling Derby's record for the earliest relegation, but a day later than Derby, so they haven't got the full earliest relegation, which is a saving grace, I guess. Not necessarily in the history books. They've scored 18 goals this season, which is one fewer than Sergio Aguero. And they conceded 59, and only Fulham have conceded more. So it didn't look like much else was happening, Tom. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on how bad were Huddersfield in the Premier League era, do you think?
Well, I mean, if we start by comparing them to that Derby side, who did in fact get the lowest ever points total in the Premier League of 11 points and had a top goal scorer of Kenny Miller in the league with 4 goals.
Oof.
I don't think they quite reached that level. They're not far off it, but like you said, they're not necessarily as bad as that one was.
Robbie Savage was Huddersfield, was Derby captain when they went down.
I was going to say, Huddersfield maybe benefit from being fairly likable. They had the cool new manager announcement.
I actually went... during that Derby season, I went to Derby away, Derby versus West Ham. West Ham beat them 5-0, and after the game...
All right, Derby are officially the worst team.
Oh, no, it gets better. After the game, I think the manager was Paul Jewell at the time. He said, when you're getting beat 5-0 by West Ham, you know there are problems.
So, Tom coming up with a perfect definition of, yes, Derby were the worst team in Premier League history. Huddersfield don't quite miss it, but... What's next for them now, Will? Where do the Terriers go from here? Because obviously, the Jan Stuart was plucked from the same
right. Yeah, yeah, they just rinsed and repeated, like, really.
Yeah. So, do they have any hope next season? Or
there's a few promising factors surrounding the club. I mean, we haven't had a sense of panic or like anger among their support that you would typically expect from a side that has just equaled the record. I think at the end of the game, the fans were sort of applauding the players, the players were applauding the fans. And even Pochettino said they've got the best home atmosphere in the country. So that's got to count for something.
Not Premier League survival. But
no.
That's what it doesn't count for.
No, but I mean, Premier League survival is not the be-all and end-all. Yeah. Many like match-going fans would say. They turned a profit this year as well. The wage bill has increased threefold by virtue of coming up to the Premier League. Parachute payments will alleviate those pressures somewhat. But it's not all rosy, because there's uncertainty surrounding not only Jan Stuart, who has, according to the Times, alienated the dressing room through behaving aggressively in the wake of defeats and has sort of dropped players without explaining why. Their owner is reportedly, also according to the Times, open to offers for the club of 60 million and above. And anyone who watched Sunderland Till I Die on Netflix knows how dangerous having a sort of half-hearted owner can be in terms of like sliding all the way down the table. And they've also like controversially scrapped their academy levels below under 18s. So they're kind of, and we've seen that have an effect in terms of their transfers. Like, so they did that in 2017, just right at the start, or just a little bit after the start of their first season in the Premier League. And then we saw that mad influx of players. I think they basically bought a whole new 11. Presumably that was sort of with an eye on, you know, inflating these development squads.
They were getting people from like, they got like Diakabi from Monaco and stuff.
Remember Tom Ince as well. I mean, I know he's found out as one of his players. He just plays well enough in the Championship to get a move to the Premier League and then leaves immediately.
And then disappoints.
They're not alone in turning for this one. I think Brentford have done similar, but that sort of mass recruitment drive reeks of stability to me. So it's a concern, but I mean, it's if they manage it in the correct
way. They need a striker. Although the mould of striker that they have, if they manage to keep them, and De Potra, who does not look...
I think they signed someone from Charlton who was kind of like, scored a few goals at lower levels as well in January.
Yeah. So you're hoping that the target men come to fruition in the Championship, if that makes sense.
The thing is as well, when you go down to the Championship, they always say at managerial level, you want experience. Wagner had experience, obviously. He already got them up through the Premier League. And with Jan Stewart, you're like, he's untested. So obviously, when they got rid of Wagner, it was an attempt to keep them up because it wasn't working. But now that it hasn't worked, they're left in a situation where if they had David Wagner, I'd be more confident for Huddersfield going back into the Championship with him as manager as I would Jan Stewart.
If they can keep some of those players together, they didn't seem to have a woeful squad. It was just they couldn't score. You mentioned on the podcast, Will, a couple of times that they were playing well in some games and just couldn't find the back of
the
net.
I remember the Liverpool game, they played particularly well. Yeah. And I think, and after that, Klopp said that Huddersfield's just don't look at Huddersfield's results. Their performances have been far greater.
Yeah, when you don't have a goal scorer, you can't consistently score goals, it just affects everything in the team, even defenders, because when you can't score goals, pressure then builds on your defence to constantly have to save you. And eventually that will crack because you can't, anyone's ever played attack v defence, know that eventually defence is cracked. So it's like, you know, it was such a ridiculous situation because their scouting is clearly quite good. You know, they've recruited players
apart
very well.
Apart
from strikers, they can't seem to identify or find a striker that will score consistently score them goals, and it's cost them in the end.
I'll tell you a defence that is cracked is Fulham's, because as we said, Huddersfield second most, but Fulham 72 goals conceded.
That's more like smashed in two clean, isn't it? Really,
and they.
I was just about to ask whether we even think Huddersfield are the worst team this season. Because
relative to money spent, definitely.
Yes, certainly. Well,
that's the thing. Fulham, first promoted team ever to spend £100 million in the summer transfer window. Yeah. And they find themselves 16 points clear from safety. They were, and many teams have been dominated by Man City this season, so that's not a surprise, but it was completely lackluster. In the first half, Kyle Walker was the only outfield player that didn't have a shot.
And he had a shot in the second half.
And then he got one and hit the post. Man City had 18 first half shots, which is the most in the opening 45 minutes of a game this season. And they're the first team in the Premier League era, I think it's the first since 1977, to concede at least twice in 12 consecutive games. So that is a good point from Will, despite having more points, purely because they have Mitrovic. That's probably the difference between Huddersfield and Fulham. Are they worse?
Yeah, but very much the theme of these relegated teams who have basically been down for weeks now is how playing out from the back has gone is now just fully mainstream. Like any club does it, not even the elite clubs. And those who I think figure, last time I checked, in the top three for failed passes inside their own half, that was basically what led to Man City's two goals. For all the chances that they were creating, they scored from two passes that went straight to the player. I think one from Sergio Rico started the move for the first one, if I'm right. And then there was a slack pass.
Frosty Mensah gave it away as well. Building out from the back is a really, really great thing to do. And it as a small side, it can give you a massive advantage. But the thing is, you have to be, as Will says, good at it. And Huddersfield and Fulham especially didn't necessarily have the defenders or not just the defenders, but the midfielders to make it work. Because it's not just about having defenders who can pass. You have to have midfielders who know where to stand and where to receive the ball. And often that doesn't always happen. And you know, people assume it's just as simple as putting a centre-back there who can pass the ball, who's fancy on it and everything. But it's not necessarily even about that. Like, John Terry is not what you would call a fancy centre-half. He was very rugged. He was an excellent passer with the ball. So it's about finding and developing these centre-backs who can pass the ball and also then developing a midfield system that allows them to always have easy passes. Because if they're having to constantly sling it 30 yards on a diagonal or something, even the best centre-backs in the world are going to give the ball away more often than not.
Yeah, but in the Championship last season, Fulham topped every probable passing metric possible.
It's Championship, isn't it?
I know, but what I'm saying is they clearly had players that could...
Oh, yeah, and then they also bought a whole new defence.
But then they bought 100 million players and then changed it so much. And there was the with Djukanovic, who Fulham fans probably wish had just stayed until the end now, because Ranieri, I see things like the Italian Felix Magath and stuff. That appointment was
that was the worst decision of the season,
and just completely derailed their season further. And then Scott Parker's doing okay, but is not.
You feel sorry for Scott Parker.
Well, their games on the Sky Sports coverage, they mentioned that they'd played four of the last five title winners, and then Liverpool, who are gunning for it.
It was like the opposite of the Solskjaer appointment at Man United, where they sort of got him in at that point because he had an easy run.
Well, I was going to say about the title race there, but we've discussed that many a time. Man City obviously winning put them top. Liverpool back over. They've still got a game in hand in midweek, Man City.
Home to Cardiff.
Which you'd expect them to win.
You would. They were phenomenal. Like, I mean, as much as Fulham were terrible, City just looked so comfortable and at ease with themselves, which in the first game back after international break is really quite something. They just, it was flowing. It was so good. Bernardo Silva, I mean... It's as much as I love Raheem Sterling, obviously then the Sterling Van Dijk thing for player of the year, Bernardo Silva might be better than both of them. I mean, the way he's played, the fact that he's made De Bruyne has basically been terrible or injured all season and no one has noticed. Like, that shouldn't be possible. He was by far City's best player last season. They should not have been able to lose him for essentially this whole season and not notice. That shouldn't be possible. Yeah. And it has been, because Bernardo Silva has stepped up in a big, bad way.
He's going to get Young Player of the Year. I told you that.
He
will get an award this season.
He's been sensational.
He fits the criteria by a day. So I was going to go from Will's mention of Solskjaer to Man United.
That's why I did it.
But let's go to Cardiff. That will obviously we're playing Man City next. I've got a stat: 4,000 the number of times Neil Warnock said the F word after Chelsea's equaliser. It was obviously a mistake. And it was obviously an error. But I was left thinking, I wonder if Neil Warnock approved VAR for the Premier League this season. Because his standoff at the end, it was amusing, it was funny, and he was obviously angry, and he has every right to be angry. But this idea that linesmen and referees can't make mistakes, when Sissoko missed a sitter, Lloris literally dropped the ball pretty much into his own net... I can't imagine the teammates would get annoyed, but because referees are these third party beings, why are they subject to not being able to make mistakes? And arguably we saw two worse ones by players, professional players. They're professional referees, yes. Warnock saying best league in the world, worst officials. But we had something in place to be able to fix that. And I don't understand why they're not allowed to do it.
It's very strange.
Like, is it enough now that the standard of refereeing is a concern, or is it just there's no help for them?
I think referees have... The idea that referees have gotten worse is because they're making more mistakes, but that's purely because, A, the game is faster now. It's much faster. It's much harder. Like, if you go watch games in the 80s, right... You watch them, and honestly, there's periods again where people are just walking around the pitch. They're just literally walking, and this is not that these were easy games. This is like in World Cup games or in major games. They're just walking around the pitch because that was the pace of play, and that's why you've got all these older pros who were pros in the 80s. Like, oh, back in my day, we'd play all season and didn't need any rest. Well, of course, because you used to walk around on the pitch for half the game. So now you're running constantly.
Ozil would have loved the 80s.
I mean, yeah, literally, he would have done. I mean, apart from all the crunching tackles, but you know, the pace of play now is so intense. Referees are, they're only human, right? They're going to be running up and that. Think of how often, as if you ever played five-a-side or ever played any sort of football, think about how often you make mistakes later in the five-a-side because you're tired, right? Now imagine you're a referee, you're running up and down, up and down, up and down. You don't get the joy of actually touching the ball. You're just looking at everyone else waiting for mistakes. You're going to make mistakes because you're tired, you're not in the right position, and it's just...
And do you know what was funny is Dave Jones, who is like quickly becoming one of my favourite people because he just only ever plays devil advocate with Graham Souness. so he just says anything that Graham Souness, the opposite of what Graham Souness said. But he was making the point that they slowed it down and they showed Willian standing in front of the linesman and it was exact in line of play. And apparently that was inexcusable. Yeah. Graham Souness says, you don't need to be up with the line of play there. Because you can see it, obviously. But imagine if the linesman wasn't up with the line of play. And when they get criticism in that end.
Well, this was what the linesman said, I think, or told Neil Warnock after the game, was that William was obstructing his view so he couldn't see the decision.
What was it, the Milner offside that led to a goal where the linesman wasn't up with play because he was standing ahead of it and didn't flag it?
Oh, was this in the West?
Yeah, I can't remember the exact game, but it was a famous like offside. And the linesman wasn't up with play, so everyone said, why are you not up with play? And now all of a sudden, because he's now up with play, but someone was standing literally in his view, and again, in real time, as Pilicueta steps back, as Manga steps forward, it looks close when the ball goes in.
Yeah.
Like, there are occasions where people are set up to make an error.
Like, that freeze frame of as Pilicueta offside was just shown so often, and I think once you draw the conclusion that he's offside and it's a criminal decision, I guarantee you some pundit on some TV channel will have used that exact word, criminal, over the weekend. It's like, where do you go from there? I mean, it's based on a desire to punish mistakes, which you, by talking about it like so expansively, when in reality, the referee's punishing himself probably. As he said to Neil Warnock, I think after the game, is like Neil Warnock came out and said they feel as bad as I do. And the reality of referees is, I mean, although I've got the impression that the standard has declined somewhat.
Yeah, that's fair.
Reality is, it's a high pressure job in terms of criticism and scrutiny, and it's totally out of step with the rewards that everyone else participating in the sport gets. Players will get praised for doing things well. Referees rarely do. I think in the Premier League, a referee will earn up to 70,000 a year, which is a lot of money, but to some, myself included, but it's like the average Premier League footballer, or probably the lowest paid Premier League footballer, will earn that in a month. And I think Bobby Madley gave an interview with BBC just a few days ago, so this was kind of like sat on the website, on the BBC Sports homepage, at the same time that this story was sort of like the main thing just before the Liverpool Spurs game. And he was talking about how they've, the PGMOL, which is the body of referees, has hired like sports psychologists to help the referees cope with the emotional fallout of a bad decision and the abuse they receive on social media.
Yeah,
they need it.
To be a referee, because as I've said, I don't think the financial rewards are really there, but to be a referee, you've have to have a sort of unlimited passion for the sport, I think. And as you go down the footballing tier, I think that's even more the case because you've got volunteers working. And anyone who's been to a football match and sat quite close to the byline knows that a linesman just makes one bad decision and then a fan just stood behind him will just pick at him for the entire game and they've just got to stand there and just sort of like not react to
and,
it.
And try and concentrate on their job. So I would, to sort of sum that bit up, I'd say, yes, there is an argument that more mistakes are being made, which you should put something in place to eradicate it, VAR. But also, the referees are making as many mistakes, if not fewer, than the actual players on the pitch. Which boggles my mind that they then come under this intense... scrutiny.
It's an easy cop-out, isn't it? Because my team did mess up, the referees messed up. And yeah, maybe the referees do mess up. As you said, the standard has dropped because the standard of football, the pace of football has improved, so that it can't keep up. That's where you need... I mean, VAR is far from perfect, right? It too can make mistakes. I've just seen this season.
They would have got that offside, though.
Yeah,
that's the obvious ones.
You need to bring it in because, by and large, it does eliminate errors. It will still make mistakes, VAR, because it is just another bunch of people looking at a screen, but it will improve it. It will improve situations. It would have... Cardiff would have won that game yesterday with VAR because red card for Rudiger, that goal wouldn't have stood. You know,
the red card for Rudiger is a bit less cut and shut, I'd say.
Yeah, because there were two players and Thingy got it anyway. But obviously, on the flip side of it, from Chelsea's point of view,
yeah.
Sarri will be so glad that they got 3 points from that. Yeah. Because halfway through it, it was, we want Sarri out. Mm. Hudson-Odoi, being his name ringing around Cardiff City Stadium, still hasn't made a Premier League start. Is there any way back now?
No.
Sorry.
It doesn't look like there is. Look, anything can happen, obviously, in football. Usually it's about on the pitch, but off the pitch, anything could happen. He could... we'll see what happens this summer, because if there's a transfer ban, then he has to keep all his players. That's really not going to be good for him. I think if it's a transfer ban, he's probably almost worse. If the transfer ban is suspended and he can buy and sell players, I think he might be okay, because then he can move on certain players, bring in some more players that will play his kind of football. Because that's the other thing. Chelsea's squad is not set up to play his kind of football at all. Not in the least. There's like 3 or 4 players that can do it. That's about it.
And even Eden Hazard, who came on and completely changed the game. And I just wanted to highlight,
yeah,
Sean Morrison won pretty much every single header in that game and made so many clearances. For the winner, which was Chelsea's first 90th minute winner since 2014, Eden Hazard was being marked in the box by Sean Morrison, walked all the way across the box to receive it, dragged two people over, cross comes back, crosses it in. Gunnarsson's filling in. It goes over his head, who Morrison would have arguably headed it,
yep.
Loftus-Cheek scores.
Eden Hazard is a very, very, very intelligent player.
But then even my point on that is, if you watch what happened when Eden Hazard came on, he was absolutely everywhere and just did everything. Yes. And we've spoken before about Sarri's patterns of play. He almost doesn't fit it, but he's so good that you allow him.
He doesn't fit it because he doesn't score as many goals as Dries Mertens does. That's the honest truth. If he was as consistently a goal scorer as Dries Mertens was,
but he plays where Insigne plays.
No, but I'm just saying, if he could score goals consistently, then Sarri could just use him up front and put him in that free role and say, just do what you want as long as you score goals.
Like because, he tries to do earlier on.
Yeah, but because Hazard isn't selfish enough, as weird as it is, because he's too much of a team player, too much of an associated player, he wants to drop deep and associate all the time, but he also wants to associate everywhere, then in Sarri's system, that's a problem. So honestly, as weird as it sounds, because he is world class, one of the top players in the world, amazing to watch, selling Hazard probably better for Sarri than keeping him, as long as they get in a replacement or, you know, play Callum Hudson.
Then that would leave them pretty much no choice but to obviously have Pulisic, Willian, Pedro and Hudson-Odoi in rotation. Higuain, no one knows if he's staying.
That doesn't look like it's
staying. But it's pretty bleak for Chelsea in terms of Champions League hopes. Man United have obviously... The resurgence under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is a main reason for that. They've made 13 points up on Spurs themselves. So that it's definitely now top two and then everyone else.
Yeah. Chelsea have an easy run to the Europa League final, though, so there's that.
They could obviously secure it that way. But in terms of league form and Man United now and their win against Watford, which obviously propelled them into this quartet of people on 60 points... it was really interesting because obviously his first permanent game in charge, Rashford scored the first goal again. Everything was almost the same. Yeah. And perhaps that is what is quite scary, perhaps. Because Louis van Gaal had this massive sort of press... I don't know what happened if he had like a massive press conference where
it was a gift of an interview.
Yeah, went into Man United, every part of it. And he was saying that his football was criticised because it was... an attacking side of play. Maybe it was slow, but it was possession based. Mm-hmm. And all Man United people wanted was someone that parked the bus, was the words he was sort of referencing, and playing counter-attacking football, which, as we've said, modern game, most people score their goals in transition now. So it's not a bad tactic. But this Watford game was odd in itself because Watford probably could say they were the better side and deserved more.
Yep.
Man United faced 8 shots on target, which is the most, joint most this season. And it's the most under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
Not surprising, Victor Lindelof didn't play in this game.
Yeah. And that, it will sort of return to Dave saves as well, because he made 7, which is, I think, was his like third highest tally at Old Trafford. Anyway, so did this game sort of give Louis van Gaal, because I know you did a piece on this, Mo, anyway, in the week that was getting quite good feedback. The one thing that was getting good feedback this week. Did it sort of prove Louis van Gaal had a point?
Yeah, I mean, the season already had proved that van Gaal was right, really. It was just the manner in which van Gaal said it. Like, he said it very much as a pejorative, like, oh, you know, I park the bus and play on the counter. It's like, yeah, they do. What's, you know, that's what suits their squad best. Like, as this game very much showed, you can't play possession football with those defenders. You'll get killed. Mm. Like Watford, they parked the bus and Watford still had 8 shots on goal against David De Gea. Like, so it's, you can't, the way United's squad is set up right now with the players they have, you can't do what United would love to do and attack and go forward and push forward. So Solskjaer said, oh, and I'm no doubt influenced by Mike Friedan, I would say, in this regard, just said, okay, let's just pull back, play defence. We've got these amazing forwards who are great on the break. We've got Paul Pogba, who is one of the best midfielders in the world, if not the best midfielder in the world, in transition. Let's just play like that and score our goals that way. It doesn't necessarily have to be defensive. It can be very fun and pulsating to watch, and it is often United are worse when they're given the ball, because then it's like, oh wait, we don't have, apart from Pogba, we don't have any creative midfielders.
Wolves games,
yeah, exactly. Like, apart from Pogba, there's no creative midfielders, and Pogba is too easily sort of put off his game sometimes. And
he was getting criticised again for Watford display.
Yeah, he's not playing well, but then he's playing with the man, Matic and Herrera, and Herrera's okay, in possession. Matic is not good in possession, and it just sort of throws Pogba off his game. Plus, also just sometimes he has bad games, Pogba. He's that kind of player. Like, sometimes he'll be pretty poor, but he'll turn it on when it counts. Kind of like a pretty much perfect Real Madrid player, which might be explained in Zinedine Zidane's comments.
Which Zidane has done a bit of flirting.
Yeah, I mean, that's more than a bit of flirting. That's a different topic. But yeah, I thought United played very sensibly in transition. I think what they need to do looking forward, it shows in the summer, they need to buy centre-halves. Because even without, you just took Lindelof out and look how much more open they became. If you took Smalling out, or Jones, if Jones didn't have a game of his life, as he always does, and then he gets injured like 5 minutes, and he's even limping at the end of this game. They would have lost the game. Genuinely, Jones was amazing. So United need to have one centre-half, maybe even two, you could argue. But Seth is certainly one to come in there and partner Lindelof so that Smalling is then a backup. Because Liverpool have shown you buy one world-class centre-half and it can change your entire team.
Yeah.
And Koulibaly, if Umtiti, if Barcelona really, I want to sell him, you buy one of those two.
Another injury-prone centre-back might not be the top
maybe
of the list.
Not, yeah. That's it.
But yeah, Van Dijk literally we didn't mention it earlier, and I feel like we'll get crucified if we didn't. I mentioned Sissoko's miss as a mistake, but obviously he was forced into that mistake by what was quite... is going to be one of the screen. If Liverpool win the title, that screenshot of one man to it's almost like John Snow drawing the sword.
One really good shot is sort of from behind the goal, so you're sort of seeing it from that was the one.
Yeah, that's the one I was referencing.
It's Sam Jackson in Pulp Fiction. I dare you. I double dare you. Yeah. Shoot, and he did.
And he played it footwork perfectly, because Sissoko takes two touches in towards Son, which is sort of bad from Sissoko's point of view. First off. Van Dijk calls that bluff and just keeps backing. Sissoko swings onto his left, which he knew was going to be weaker and could have put it anywhere in the goal, blazed over, and then obviously Hugo Lloris drops a blunder. So we just wanted to say, remember, we do think Van Dijk is very, very good player.
Second
best. When are you going to acknowledge that he has no weakness? Yeah, Van Dijk has no weaknesses.
So Will said it for everyone. I just said it
so that we could put as the headline for this podcast. Yeah. Van Dijk has no weakness.
Well, you can go back to that infamous Maldini quote. As soon as I make a tackle, I know I've done something wrong. Yeah. He didn't have to make a tackle.
He literally didn't make a tackle.
Exactly.
In that game.
Are you saying he's the new Maldini, Tom? Can I just get you on board?
Van Dijk is the new Maldini.
that's why we Thank got you. Tom on. But yeah, just to address that, because we never said he wasn't bad, and we were discussing what Ryan Bowell said rather than saying he had one himself. So with that, and with that disclaimer, we'll take a little break and we'll be back with a little Squawker Scout. Squawker Scout section is going to be slightly different in the sense that we're going to focus on one particular player. When we ask for listeners' questions each week, we usually get someone asking about what the hell is going on with Mauro Icardi. So we thought we'd decide to focus on the Argentinian this week, because in a bizarre turn of events this weekend, 50 days since he last played for Inter Milan, he was set to be in the team. Lautaro Martinez was injured, so it was like Icardi trained with the team all week, and then Spalletti said we couldn't put him in the team because he hadn't said sorry to his teammates, or there was an ill feeling.
He seemed to suggest that there had been a new development in training that week.
So he said Something happened again and we couldn't play him, and it led to them playing Balde Keita up front, who is can play as a forward and played up there for Lazio in sort of with another person up front. He was their leading centre forward and they lost 1-0 at home. So the question is, as we said, what on earth is going on with Icardi, a man who has scored 122 goals in 210 games for Inter Milan, but hasn't played for nearly 2 months?
So it's a situation Inter Milan's manager, Luciano Spalletti, has described as humiliating after Sunday in his post-match press conference. So the player and the club are sort of publicly contradicting each other. We saw reports that emerged earlier in the week suggesting that Icardi was about to be reintegrated back into the squad, as you said, to replace Martinez. Then Spalletti obviously came out on Friday and said and confirmed this would not be the case. So obviously, like I say, they're both contradicting each other, so it's difficult to know what to believe. I think the latest is that Wanda Nara, Icardi's wife and agent, came out this morning and said he's ready to play. It's the club's decision not to reintegrate him. Beppe Marotta, who's their CEO, says he's going to be reintegrated gradually. But what we do know is that he's not played since mid-February, after supposedly sustaining a knee injury shortly after being removed as club captain. However, at the start of March, Luciano Spalletti said he'd been cleared, he'd been past fit to play, but was telling the club that he felt pain still. He was past fit to play by the medical staff, but was telling the club that he couldn't play. And so this is all tied in with the fact that there are fraught contract negotiations ongoing. His contract expires in 2021, so the stakes are basically, if they don't get him to renew this summer, then the next transfer window, January of 2020, will
he's depreciating rapidly.
Exactly. And yeah, so it's basically a mess.
Yeah,
and just everyone's contradicting each other.
He's had a complicated relationship with Inter in general. As you said, he was club captain for a while. But
previously been stripped of it, I think, because in his book criticised the club's ultras.
Yeah,
they were then protested outside his house, I think.
So
quite ugly scene. So
it's all a bit bizarre. But as I said, his record for them is undeniable.
Yeah.
And as a striker who has very few touches in a game, he's scored hat-tricks in the Milan derby. As a player, he's celebrated, but then there's this... Because even with Argentina...
His removal as club captain kind of came at a point where the goals had dried up slightly.
Yeah.
I think he'd only had a couple in quite a few games. He certainly wasn't scoring at the same rate he was during the earlier part of the season, so it would seem that what's kept him in the team in previous disputes has basically been his indisputable ability scoring less goals.
Why hasn't Klopp dropped Salah yet then?
Salah is probably a much more reasonable bloke to manage.
I mean, if you've seen the interview he had after the match, Jamie Carragher, you would know he is. He seems like a lovely fella. Even when he was being quote-unquote arrogant, he was nice and funny with it. Icardi is a phenomenal footballer, right? Genuinely brilliant goal-scoring striker. The reason why he doesn't get picked for Argentina, right? Higuain keeps messing up in finals, is now retired. Aguero never really puts it on until just literally this past World Cup for Argentina, never really performed. Like he's had two good tournaments for Argentina, 2008 Olympics, 2018 World Cup, everything else qualifies, everything is rubbish, right?
That Olympics team was so good.
He was so, you're thinking, okay, this is serious. And then he's never really kicked on from that. So why hasn't Icardi got a chance? Well, I mean, it's the whole thing with Wanda Nara, Maxi Lopez. Maxi Lopez is friends with Mascherano. Mascherano, obviously, very influential in the dressing room. So it's sort of been like, it's the quote unquote bad feeling. You know, you can't pick him because he's...
It's the politics of football.
Yeah,
his story is one of the most interesting in football. I'm not in a way that reflects well on him.
Yeah. We can't wait for his book.
I mean, goodness, yeah.
He's already done one.
I can't wait.
I can't wait for part two.
I can't wait for the Netflix special, mate. That's what I want.
That would be excellent. I would say just briefly, the surrounding context, though, is that Inter are third so safe in those Champions League spots, but that defeat to Lazio has puts them only 5 points ahead of Lazio, who are in fifth. But Lazio have a game in hand. So
they're going to need a card back.
So, that might hasten his return to the squad.
Yes.
So if he does return, then obviously, because he's quite a streaky player anyway, so you notice that the goals dry up. But if you look at, he was top scorer last season, but it was very much like, I'm going to score 10 in 5 and then have a break and then score another 10 in 5. If he does come back in the team, sort of secures their Champions League spot, it does look like this is going to be the summer where they're going to be most favourable towards a sale and maybe push towards that if the contract's not sorted then. So Mo, I wanted to come for you first from Icardi's side. Where do you think he should be going?
Real Madrid. This guy is a Real Madrid player, 110%. If, you know, he's got a massive personality, you know, and to be able to cope, to be able to beef with the ultras of an Italian football club and win, essentially, which is what he did by staying in the side because he produced so much, that takes something. I mean, to be able to endure the scorn, slings and arrows of Italian ultras and keep playing well takes something. The Bernabeu are famously hostile towards its own players. Gareth Bale's won the two Champions Leagues. They still boo the guy every chance he gets. So, you know, you need a certain kind of mental strength to handle the Bernabeu. He has that very much, obviously. He doesn't like Messi, so that immediately will endear him to the Bernabeu faithful. Or he doesn't get on with Messi, let's say. And he's just a great goal scorer, and that's what they need. They need someone up front who bangs in the goals because they sold a guy who did that fantastically. And I know he hasn't got that quite prowess, but look, he's got basically 1 in 2 for Inter, right? He's got 10 and 21 in Europe, if you want to discount Serie A, 10 and 21, so he's got a 1 in 2 record in Europe, 4 and 6, sorry, in his only Champions League against Real this season. In the group of death, he scored 4 goals, you know, important goals as well, bagged one against Barcelona. That equalised and he barely touches the ball, so it's perfect for Real Madrid, for Zidane's Real Madrid in particular. They don't need to involve him in football. They can build a team around him where the team plays football and he just literally does what Cristiano used to do for Zidane's Madrid, which was just show up at the end and score a goal. And it's such a I know the Madrid media are now pushing this whole Benzema's the best number 9 in the world, but he's not. So
that's what I was going to just quickly sort of counter attack with was Benzema, not necessarily, they are different players. They all play different roles. But he's, again, a resurgence. Alvaro Odriozola has come out and said he's the best number 9.
Yeah.
Vinicius took a picture with him and said the number 9 that plays as a 10. So there's this whole romance again that Benzema is this underappreciated talent that wears the number 9 and carries the burden that a number 9 would have, but plays as a number 10.
You talk about streaky players, that's because he's played. Yeah. You know, we had this period earlier in the season where I foolishly wrote an article saying he was about to Wayne Rooney and score like 30 goals. Because this is what he does. Benzema has these runners of form where he plays like, oh my God, this guy's impeccable.
But,
and then it sort of drops off and then it comes back.
But the Wayne Rooney comparison's almost quite nice because Rooney did have those two seasons where he was a goal scorer. Yeah. And I remember there were sort of VTs on him. I practiced heading in the box and he kept scoring headers from like 4 yards out. And there was this real sort of commitment to becoming a number 9. And then obviously famously withdrew. And now plays where he wants and plays as
they are similar players. That's why I made the comparison. Because they do play like each other. They have the same body type, the same issues with weight. It's all there really.
So could Benzema, if Icardi goes to Real Madrid as your sort of choice, which is again funny because he was obviously La Masia.
Yeah.
Born and raised to an extent.
Wow.
I'm just saying that as sort of throw away the fact he was there.
Yeah, he was there.
Could he play with Benzema?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, you look at Benzema, if you're talking about players, strikers, world-class strikers that you want to play in a 4-4-2, Benzema's got to be one of the top ones because he's such an associative player, such a selfless player. He'll pass the ball. He won't hog the limelight. In fact, I think his ideal situation would be in a 4-4-2 with a goal-scoring striker like Icardi.
What does that mean for the rest of the team?
Well, effectively, when Real Madrid played so well under Zidane, they effectively played with Cristiano Benzema up front in a 2. So you could just go back to the diamond formation that Madrid played. You could play a 4-4-2 because Zidane is sexy Moyes, as we've said before. Loves crosses, you know, big fan of crosses. So you bring in Eden Hazard, world class winger. You know, he's gonna be firing chop crosses and cutbacks from the left side. You put Vinicius on the right, or unleash Carvajal on the right.
Asensio
could be on the right. So you know, you play 4-4-2 and make it happen. You got Paul Pogba, you know?
So if Icardi goes to Real Madrid, Inter Milan are gonna need a striker.
Yes.
As we said in Lazio, they were lacking exactly that. Tom, if you were Inter Milan's CEO, who would you be chasing to replace the mercurial captain?
Well, if we go to Squawker's inside sources, Diego Forlan, I'm joking, he's not our inside sources. But
speaking to ESPN. but please make that clear.
On Friday he said that according to the club, which he has spoken to, Inter are going to sell Icardi this summer and replace him with Griezmann, which I think would be a massive step down for Griezmann. No offence to Inter Milan, but obviously they aren't.
No offence, but offence.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically why Icardi's going, because he's played like 6 Champions League games for Inter, essentially.
I mean, their Champions League campaign this year was nothing short of a bit of a disgrace. Like, they were in the driving seat to get qualification, to lose to already knocked out PSV on a day they had to win. I know at the time the loss would have been acceptable had Tottenham got not got that last minute equaliser, but I'm sorry, that that if you want to be a big club, you have to qualify, but to get knocked out in that manner, like, Tottenham were dead and buried. So that's why I think, I love Inter Milan, but again, they're a shadow of the glory days.
From an Inter Milan perspective, they get Griezmann, that's a pretty...
That would be massive for them, yeah. For Griezmann, I think it'd be a step down, but for Inter Milan, obviously, Icardi is just, like you said, is a phenomenal striker. Griezmann is probably equally as phenomenal, but in different ways. But yeah, this whole thing with Icardi fighting with... I mean, it's just been an ongoing battle for the past couple of years, fighting with the ultras, now this... If he stays, will it be something different next season? Whereas with Griezmann, obviously you've got the yearly interview where he claims he's going to Barcelona and then complains afterwards that the tabloids are always making up rumours.
So with Inter, like, the subject of so many, like, I don't want to say far-fetched, because that would be as disrespectful as Tom just was, really.
But I'm going to say far-fetched.
But I'll go with it, because I can't think of anything else. They were also linked with Luka Modric, weren't they?
Yeah.
When he was at his sort of contract, his own contract impasse, basically. I mean, I don't think it will happen, but Griezmann and Modric to Inter Milan.
Griezmann.
An interesting little... I mean, Griezmann replacing Icardi just offers so much more. Maybe not the same... Well, not too far off the same level of output in terms of goals, but Griezmann just offers so much more. You could question whether is that...
That's what they need, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Griezmann would be a perfect 10 to play behind Lautaro as a 9. Like, they would be a great strike partnership, speaking of strike partnerships. And I think Griezmann, in terms of pure talent and ability to dominate games, I think he's top 3 in the world for me. He's genuinely sensational. He's just at the absolute worst possible club in terms of... we'd always rag on Lukaku for his big game, or people always rag on Lukaku for not dominating big games, because often he's playing in teams that don't do that. Everton, West Brom, Man United under Mourinho, you know. So, and Griezmann is the same thing. He's playing for a very, very defensive team. He is 85% of their attack.
So this is the thing, though, is that if we're going to believe Diego Forlan, there are also other reports that suggest that Griezmann has gone to Barcelona.
Yeah. Already. Well, that was actually another footballer, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was the Patrice former... Evra's best mate.
Yeah, Jerome Rothen.
So someone's got to be lying. And we don't know who it is just yet, but some of us wait and see. I had a little theory craft of a potential striker that would require a lot of risk, but Moise Keane has been sort of really prolific for Italy and Juventus recently.
I think he scored the winner for Juventus this weekend.
Yeah, he came on and scored within 2 minutes. So it's unlikely Juventus would sell in, and I'm not saying this
not
is
to Inter,
definitely
not to Inter.
Well, it happens in Serie A. There's no one has any qualms
about that. Not as good as Moise Keane.
But there could be some sort of 2-year car ownership deal, buyback, loan, free transfer deal.
Yeah,
but
the
only reason it made me think of this was because Moise Keane is bizarrely in the sense that, because he's young, idolises Mario Balotelli, who was a cult figure at Inter Milan himself, was a winger, started off, was on the quest of becoming a striker. I just think maybe Inter Milan could be a sexy enough project to maybe promise Moise Keane full games, and again work in synthesis with Martinez, who is also a very good, exciting young talent. But that was just my thought on that, if anyone wanted to hang around and listen to that. As we said, Forlan says Griezmann's going, and Icardi to Real Madrid, according to Mo, which sums up quite an interesting Squawker Scout section. Unfortunately, that's all we've got time for this week's episode, so that just leaves me to say thank you to our 3 guests. I hope you enjoyed the extra person on the podcast. So first of all, thank you, Mo.
Thank you, Jake.
Will, thank you for joining us.
The pleasure was all mine.
And Tom, how was your debut?
Yeah, it was really good. Good experience.
Enjoyed it. Unfortunately, we will decide by a Twitter vote whether you'll be back on. So you'll have to look out for that. In the meantime, listeners, please rate, please review, please subscribe. And please tell us we don't know anything about football again this week, because I would love that.